Accession number 28361, Reel 27.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 27. You were saying AF North was more professional than AF South, and you mentioned that there were Germans in it and they were more British, and that it was less maritime than AF South.
I think I got the impression it was. Whether that's right or not, I don't know. It also linked in more positively. I think this is my perception later with the central region, because it after all had a contiguous bit of the country, i.e. the Jutland Peninsula and all that, so I think it looked upon itself more as an extension of the central region than AF South tended to look on itself as being a separate set up altogether.
It's geographically autonomous, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas AF North, had it not been for the Danes and Norwegians' distaste for working with Germans, it would never have existed.
It probably would never have existed, really, no.
Right. Was there anything of that feeling left that you could detect of a sort of Danish and Norwegian coolness towards the Germans?
I didn't detect it, no.
If we go back to AF South for a while, something that's occurred to me is you mentioned the Warsaw Pact as being important. But of course, the Mediterranean has a southern shore as well.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if, while you were there, there were ever any considerations of possible operations in North Africa or indeed in Levant in the eastern Mediterranean.
Not that I knew of. I mean, there may have been plans kept secret from us, but certainly none that I knew of at all.
You had no exercises, even paper exercises, about Algeria or Tunisia or Morocco or anything like that?
No.
Because by this time Libya had gone, hadn't it?
Libya had gone.
Distinctly unfriendly.
Yeah, very unfriendly. And Libya, I can't remember when it did go, went in, was it late 60s?
Very late 60s.
I think it went. And the other sort of little, I suppose one would call it sort of pimple, was the position of Malta, because in the early part of my time as brigade major, the commando that had been based in Malta was moved out of there twice, I think, sent back to England twice and then brought back again, because Mintoff was being difficult. And eventually they went back to Malta, and so we had a commando, we had three in the UK and one based in Malta for all my time as brigade major. And of course we used to pick that commando up and exercise it from time to time.
Was that because Mintoff had been temporarily replaced by Bourg-Olivier as the...
I don't know, I can't remember, but there was a... He was playing games, trying to do deals with the then British government and get out of Malta. So they left Malta in sort of the late 72, came back to England, then went back to Malta again, then were packed off again. I think they sort of did it twice, and eventually they were allowed back there, and I'm not quite sure who was then the Prime Minister.
Wasn't there some idea that he was trying to extract money as rent for the base facilities or
something like that?
And what about the position of Gibraltar, the other rather delicate territory in the Western Mediterranean? Was there any difficulty that you were aware of there?
None. That I were. I mean, the whole time that I was BM, the border was closed to Spain. We used to go to Gibraltar quite a lot, because a typical deployment to the Mediterranean would involve the amphibious ships loading in the UK with the vehicles and the chaps, setting sail, and then we would be sort of finishing off back in Plymouth, getting as much work done as we possibly could until we sort of went into limbo, which is what an exercise involved. All the sort of normal work got forgotten. And then we'd fly to Gibraltar and meet the ships. We'd gain 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And then we would do the thing that we always did when we got to George, is run to the top of the rock.
Mm.
And then sail off to wherever we were going to do our exercises.
Mm.
So we used to go there 3 or 4 times a year, I guess, to Gibraltar.
No sense.
Then we'd fly back the same way,
yes,
too.
No sense that anyone was trying to press the issue of Gibraltar at that time.
No. The Royal Marines have a very sort of proprietary interest in Gibraltar, as you can imagine.
Of course.
We always regard it as ours, which is why we always run to the top of the rock whenever we go there.
Mm. So you've done a lot of exercises in the Mediterranean. You've done one exercise in the north of Norway, so on. And you were kept very busy all this time, planning exercises, conducting and so forth.
Then we did exercises in the UK, of course.
Oh, and in the UK. What were you doing?
Well, we did exercises in the Orkneys, which was actually a preparation for the Norway exercise.
Was this landing?
And then, I mean, it was a pretty basic exercise because there are not many training areas there, but it gave us the opportunity to sort of island hop and things like that using landing craft and helicopters.
Mm.
And then we used to do exercises, CP exercises on Dartmoor and Salisbury Plain and Stanford training area.
Mm. Without troops?
Just the CP.
Mm.
We'd go out and spend a week out.
Mm.
And then we'd have to write a little thing, scenario, so we'd have sort of things coming in. And really it was procedures we were buffing up on.
Mm.
So we were really training a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And then we had one long period-ish, in the sense that it was the longest sort of CPX I've done. It was about 2 weeks on Stanford training, where we were trying to hone this business of the two headquarters. We'd in and see how it worked.
Whose idea was that? Was that your idea?
Well, it was my idea, and the chap who was the brigade signals, who was very hot on the business of intercepts and things like that, who said, you know, we're just not going to survive.
Yeah.
And he'd actually been attached to a mechanized infantry brigade in Germany on an exchange, and had seen how often they expected to move.
Yeah.
Because of this business of survival. Mm. Now, it's easy for a mech infantry brigade to just pick up their tents and
close
go.
Close the doors and
close
drive
the
off.
Doors and drive off.
Mm.
Well, we couldn't do that, so we had to invent a way of doing it.
Mm.
So that worked quite well.
Mm.
And we practiced it at Stanford, you know, in the Thetford training era.
Mm. What happened to you after you came to the end of your tour?
I then went to the DS at Camberley.
Because you've done 2 years, haven't you?
Yeah, I did 2 years.
Very hectic.
Very hectic.
Okay.
And then I went to Camberley as a DS,
mm-hmm.
Which was great fun. I enjoyed that enormously. I enjoyed being brigade major, actually, too.
Mm.
But I felt quite bereft when I finished being BM, because you have so much influence and power. Well, I suppose it's not power, but it's to do get things right or to get them wrong, you feel totally sort of that there isn't actually going to be anything left to do. Of course, we're quite wrong, so there are many things left to do.
Mm.
But anyway, I then went to Camberley as a DS for 2 years.
What were you doing there? What sort of?
Well, I was teaching, so I was in one of the divisions, BDIV. Was I BDIV or ADIV? BDIV. And I was a teaching DS, so I was taking syndicates for all the phases of war, and on top of that I was running the joint team, so we which was a naval officer, an air force officer, and me, and our job was to write and run the two joint periods of instruction which we had at Camberley each year.
How long were those periods?
Each one was 2 weeks to begin with. They were then shortened to 1 week. Because it was less and less jointery during that time.
Less and less jointery?
Less jointery.
What was driving that, do you think?
I think what was driving that was a reduction in the size of the Navy. a lack of interest in joint operations by the Navy and the Army. Mm. The jewel in the crown of British defence were the four armoured divisions in Germany. Mm. The Air Force wasn't really interested in joint operations, only in being RAF Germany and you know, in that role. And certainly by the period leading up to the Falklands War, by 1980, most joint schools had been disbanded, most joint publications had been discontinued, and joint training was... And this was the start of it. When I'm talking about 1974 or 5, this is the start of the decline and of the whole business of jointery. And which, of course, is now revived hugely.
Mm, indeed.
But it was then, you know, on the graph, it was doing that.
It was going towards an nadir.
It was going towards an nadir and was exceedingly worrying. So my first year at Cambly, the joint period was 2 weeks in the summer and 2 weeks in the autumn. And my second year in Cambly, they'd been both reduced to a week.
Now, you mentioned that the Jewel and the Crown was the four armoured divisions in the AOR. Then, I mean, what was occupying the Navy? What were they?
Well, the Navy's main thrust was the anti-submarine battle in the North Atlantic to get those convoys of reinforcements across the Atlantic. Mm.
Which would mean they wouldn't have to cooperate with the armoured divisions.
No. Mm. I don't mean that there was a sort of, we don't want to cooperate with you because we don't like you. It was just that was the thrust of the way that the people could see their future.
Couldn't see a need.
They couldn't see a need because after all, the enemy was the Warsaw Pact, who was visible above the parapet, well, like a row of figure 11 targets all the time. And therefore, you could work out quite easily what you needed in order to counter that.
Do you think this was also driven partly by the decline in interests beyond the NATO area because of the rundown of the Far East and Middle East?
Absolutely. It was all part of that. Mm. And it was part of something which I get exercised about, which I call sort of strategic hubris, which imagines that you can see the future. That you know what's going to happen. Mm.
Well, every planner is required to make an estimate of the future.
Sure.
Absolutely. A humble and speculative kind of way.
Sure. But his superiors should be aware of the greater world, which is uncertain and will come up with some very nasty surprises which you haven't catered for. Mm. That's that, and I think that had sort of begun to die. Mm. That whole concept. I mean, Mike Clapp, this is maybe a red herring, but it illustrates the point, I think, told me the other day that when he was discussing some paper with the then First Sea Lord, Edward Ashmore, in the late 70s, in the MOD, he said to him, you know, Mike, you're never going to go to war again, you know. Mm. It'll never happen in your time. Mm. The First Sea Lord said to me in December 1981, there'll never be another amphibious landing. Okay, so that's the mindset that people have got themselves into.
Well, they'd said that after 1956 because of the difficulties encountered in Port Said and so on, hadn't they?
Yeah, indeed. And I think that there was a climate of, and it was partly Treasury driven, you know, pressure on defence spending, and a way of keeping afloat was to dump the bits that you could argue would not be necessary.
Well, there's always Treasury pressure, isn't there? It's constant. And
absolutely. Yeah. But the way that they reacted to it on this occasion was dumping the bits that they didn't think were necessary. And of course, there were other drivers. The one that I've talked about is a huge cost of maintaining four armoured divisions in BAOR and a big air force with huge costs with families and all the sort of infrastructure and mundungery that went with it. Secondly, the pressure on the Navy because of Trident was that Trident was going to come out of the naval budget and would not come out of a special budget as Polaris had come. Mm. And so for the Navy, we're then going to have to find the money to fund Trident. Mm. And the way they did that was they were going to dump amphibious forces.
But at the same time, I mean, you were saying that AF North was not maritime, not as maritime as AF South, but you had got this business of having to think about action in the North Norwegian Sea when the Soviet Northern Fleet started coming out around the North Cape. I mean, was this because naval forces in that area were under Sakland and therefore not part of AF North?
Yeah, Sakland, you see, was going to fight that battle. He was a what do they call it? I can't remember, what was the name given to the three Sakyo, Sakland, and Sing Chan. They were what were they called? Primary, what was the buzzword? Primary NATO commanders, or
Sing
something.
Sing Chan was British, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he also had another hat. He was equivalent, I mean, in theory, not actually in practice, to Sakland.
Well, couldn't be, not in terms of.
Yes, he was. Sing Chan.
Yes, but not in terms of actual capability.
Oh, no. But Sing Chan, the three NATO commanders were Sakhil, Sakland, and Sing Chan. Chan.
Yeah.
Sing Chan had a second hat as Com East Land. He wore two hats. But they were, whatever they, you know, it just shows you how quickly these buzzwords drop out of one's mind. But they were called principal NATO commanders or some PNCs or something. Now, because Sakland was a PNC, he was going to fight that North Atlantic battle in the way that Sing Chan was going to fight the Channel battle. So AF North had a sort of boundary, which was, I don't know how far out it went from the North Norway or from the Norwegian shore, but it didn't go out far.
Coastal waters only.
It was coastal waters only. And he was looking in the other direction, you see, most of the time. He was looking east.
Yes, but then of course he also had to look.
And he had to look south.
Southeast through Kombaltan.
Absolutely. But I'm not saying they didn't have a maritime interest. That would be absolute nonsense to say. Of course they did. But what I meant was that AF South always had a maritime, a sort of dark blue feel to it.
Yeah.
Because it was sort of Mediterranean littoral.
Major land masses were separated by water.
Never separated by water.
Yes.
And there was a sort of, I mean, maybe this is an illusion on my part, but I always felt that there was a much stronger sort of dark blue taste to it. And of course, influenced by the fact that we had a very large US fleet in there. The Sixth Fleet was a big fleet. And they were a major player in the Mediterranean. Major player.
But it's rather peculiar if you think of the national traditions of Denmark and Norway, which are really rather more maritime and naval than military. Outlook.
But they tended to be coastal. They tended to be coastal.
They invaded Britain from across the sea.
Many centuries earlier. No, yes. I agree. I'm just saying that because.
That was the flavour at the time.
The flavour of time, and also because of that Jutland link. And I can come on to that later when I'm talking about being brigade commander, when I was actually wrecking in Jutland and talking to the Germans about how we fought the battle in Jutland. You had to talk to the Germans because you couldn't sort of draw a line and say, well, you know, we're AF North boys and you're these guys. You know, you couldn't. Because the enemy wasn't going to recognise that line. You had to work with them. And so
the enemy was going to go straight along that line if they could find
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So you had to work with them. But you didn't have to do that in the South because you had that sort of tier of neutral or non-playing or doubtful countries which sandwiched you off, like Austria,
Switzerland,
Yugoslavia, question mark, Bulgarians, question mark, which gave that sort of fuzzy feeling to the edges.
Now you're saying you were so you got joinery which was in decline, and then you got the teaching of syndicates. But now you'd been at Camberley earlier on.
Yeah, as a student. Yeah.
Was the syllabus the same as when you had been there?
Practically.
Had it changed?
Practically identical. The bits that were different were the what I would call the coin, the counterinsurgency. Instead of looking at counterinsurgency in sort of faraway places, you were looking at counterinsurgency very much related to Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
So that the exercise was, for example, set in Aberdeen disguised as somewhere else, you know, but it was actually, it had a very much a Northern Ireland flavour to it. But other than that, other than the fact that over the 10 years, because it was exactly 10 years since I'd been there, much had been done to uprate the British Army's mobility in terms of APC, armoured personnel carriers, and Warrior was just beginning to come on the stream, and all that sort of thing. Most of the exercises were the same. And other than that, I mean, there were hardly any changes.
Mm. What about the methods of instruction?
Methods of instruction were the same. Mm. The only difference was there was a difference of feel, in that I remember being marched in to see the commandant, who was then Pat Howard Dobson.
Ah, yes.
Who was a very nice man.
7th Hussar, I think.
Yeah. And he was in the 4th Armoured Brigade in Burma.
Yes.
And he said to me, the difference you'll find between here now and when you were here as a student is that in the days that you were a student, all the DS were brevet lieutenant colonels, and it was by no means guaranteed that they would go on. They're now proper lieutenant colonels, and therefore they do not feel the need to get a leg up in their careers by standing on the faces of their students.
Wow.
And that's perfectly true. Some of the nicer DS didn't care, when I was a student, I mean, but there were one or two gentlemen who got the opinion that all that they were cared about was their promotion, and being sarcastic and rude and unkind to students was, if they thought that would enhance their careers, they would do so. Mm. Well, that had totally disappeared, that atmosphere, when I went back as a DS, because everyone was a substantive lieutenant colonel. Mm. Everyone was guaranteed, unless they completely screwed up, that they would go on to command. So secure in that knowledge, they were able to make certain the students not only learnt but enjoyed learning at the same time. And I thought it was fantastic. I learnt much more as a DS than I did as a student, actually.
Well, there's nothing like having to teach something to force them to learn it.
Absolutely. And I taught all phases of war. I didn't just teach jointery. I mean, I taught, advanced, the whole thing. Mm. And of course, it was a wonderful preparation for being a CO, which was the next thing.
Indeed.
You see.
How what about the students? Well, how would you say, had the quality of the students changed at all? Were they about the same level in their development, or were they?
I'd say they're
back?
Actually better than
they're
ours,
better.
Because I think there was a higher. I don't think in my year at Camberley, when I was a student, there were more than a handful of graduates, and they were the exception. Mm. They were chaps who'd gone to university and then joined the army.
Yeah.
None of them were in service, had in service degrees. Many of the students, when I was a DS, I don't think the majority, because we're talking about chaps who would have joined the army, and we're talking about 1974, so they would have been at Sandhurst, 10 years before?
Mm.
So not many of them were, but there were more than had been in the past, people with degrees. So on the whole, they were intellectually ahead, I say, of the lot that I was there with.
Do you remember any in particular who stand out in your memory?
Yes, I remember Hugh Pike, who was a student, who then became a CO under my command and then GOC and all that. I remember David Chandler, who I know. I remember them now, not in sort of hindsight, as it were. I remember several of them, as being. Anthony Denison Smith, who was one of my students. There were a couple of very bright Marines, one of whom became my brigade major when I was brigade commander. There were some good guys there, actually. Mm.
Did you find that you could spot the good guys very early on in the process?
Well, you sometimes could. I sometimes think that some students rumble the system because they've got the ability to work the system to their advantage. I mean, the chap who got, I hark back to my student days there, the chap who was top of our course, we recognised was fooling the system.
Oh, why was he managing to do that?
Well, just by being, the chap who asked all the bright questions, had all the clever answers, and was the first on his feet, in the Allen Brook when it came to, demonstrating how clever he was. Mm. And he was very personable. He then had a nervous breakdown once commanding a battalion in Belfast.
Was he playing a part, do you think?
He was playing a part.
Being the spring butt in the lecture hall.
Yeah, he was playing a part. Mm. And when push came to shove, he couldn't take it.
Mm. But I mean, that's a matter of...
But his fellow students could see that.
Yes.
But his dears, because they didn't have the knowledge that we had, did not see it. And I was always conscious of that when I was looking at my students at Staff College. You know, was I being taken in by this chap's personable social skills, the loquaciousness, his ability to write well, etc.
But intellectual ability and charm are not the same thing as the qualities of temperament and character that you require for command
Absolutely.
Under stress, are they?
No, and they're not necessarily tested at Staff College, you see.
Well, Staff College was set up to produce staff officers.
Sure.
Not commanders.
That, you're quite
Although,
correct.
I mean, it was later called the Commander and Staff College.
Yeah. What is now at Shrivenham called that.
Yes, the training was designed to produce people with those staff skills.
Absolutely.
That were originally going to be a separate stream.
Exactly. And I'm not blaming Staff College. I mean, I think Staff College, Camberley, was the most fantastic place, and I think the quicker they reinvent it, the better.
Well, it was certainly a very effective working institution.
And they're going to reinvent it. I mean, this is a red herring, but I can talk about it when we're in between tastes. But no, I thought it was a brilliant Staff College, and the point was that it was designed to turn out grade 2 staff officers.
Well, it wasn't perfect, but it was a very effective.
No. When I say that. You know, some people kid fool the system.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing the system. I'm just criticizing the fact that it's run by human beings who can be taken in by, you know, what I would call military con men, effectively.
Yes.
Like anybody else can be taken in by con men.
Well,
you know,
any large organization.
You know. Yeah.
Is bound to attract those who will use what skills they have
Absolutely.
To get on beyond their capabilities if they can.
Absolutely. So. And you're quite right, it wasn't meant to be a command college, it was to turn out grade 2 staff officers, which it did jolly well. And I think it was I loved my time there. I'm a great fan of Camberley. I was very happy there. And I learned a huge amount.
What about the overseas contingent? Were they substantial at that time? Were there any
I don't think they were as big as the proportion you get now. I've just come from talking at the Staff College last week.
There was, I think, a rule generally at that time that they didn't want more than about 10% of overseas because it would dilute.
I don't know what the percent was, and of course we then ran what would nowadays would be regarded as a very unpolitically correct system, which was that. In the final term, everyone except NATO and old Commonwealth, who were not necessarily NATO, I mean the Canadians were, of course, but the Australians most certainly were not, and New Zealanders, remained on, and then you went into NATO secret, up to NATO secret. Yes. And then in the final half of the last term, everyone was out except Americans, Australians, and New Zealanders and Canadians.
That was the nuclear phase, I think.
No, the nuclear phase was the term before, and everyone stayed for everyone. We did the nuclear phase at NATO secret, so the others, non-NATO, went. But the final 3 weeks or 4 weeks, whatever it was UK, Americans, Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders only. So even Germans and French NATO guys were out, which made it a bit of a problem when you were trying to look around for talent for the pantomime.
Why was that so sensitive, that last...
You did a lot of UK only and American only stuff, and it was mainly sort of lectures on UK defence policy, and that sort of thing. Yeah. And it's also very important because we were rehearsing the pantomime.
It has been said at times the pantomime was more important than anything else in determining your performance.
Absolutely.
And your grading.
Absolutely.
Has there been any changes in the way in which the exercises were run, the telephone battles, for example, did they reflect the sort of changes in headquarters structures that you've been describing earlier?
A bit, in the sense that the organisation it reflected it a bit in that they made them move around more, you know, from one room to the other and that sort of thing. But rarely it was the same, and of course you've got to remember that this is pre-computers.
There's still telephone battles.
There's still telephone. This is pre-IT. You're still back in the dark age, you know, with
pencil
telephones.
And paper.
Pencil and paper. There's no